And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io.
And we're back for another episode of the Startup Hustle. This is your host, Matt Watson. Very excited to be joined today by Steve Wolf. He's got all the money, guys. We're going to try and get some money out of him today. He's the managing partner and co-founder of Growth Street Partners. You know, they specialize in growth equity, practical founders, practical, you know, people that aren't trying to raise hundreds of millions of dollars, but are trying to run like a normal business, but they just need to raise like $1 million, $5 million, whatever, right? Like that's all they need. Like most of us, that's probably all we need. So Steve is a guy, we're gonna talk more about raising money as a practical founder today, sensible fundraising. So before we get started, I do want to remind you today's episode is brought to you by Fullscale, which is my company. We have over 300 employees in the Philippines and do all kinds of software development. We build teams for our clients, long-term teams, whatever they need, full front-end, mobile, QA, back-end, all kinds of development. Check us out at fullscale.io. Steve, can I get some money, man? I need some money.
Oh, well, First of all, Matt, I appreciate you inviting me onto the podcast, and the best way to get money is inviting me onto the podcast.
Perfect.
Yeah. But I'm really excited to be here. I really appreciated the way that you described our firm and trying to back practical founders solving real problems. That is what Growth Street's all about. You know, I'm happy to give you the background on the firm and the types of investing we make, but excited to be here.
Well, I think a lot of people are trying to figure out, can I raise big money? How much money should I raise? All that kind of stuff. And I'd love you to, you know, walk us through that a little bit in our conversation today. But to start, yeah, tell us a little more about your background. Give us the quick elevator pitch on your background and Growth Street. I know you guys manage over $200 million in your funds. Like, tell us a little bit about you guys.
Yeah, so Growth Street Partners is based in San Francisco. We typically invest, call it $5 to $15 million, in vertical SaaS and tech-enabled services companies that are doing maybe $2 to $5 million of annual recurring revenue. So they've got something that works, but they haven't really quite figured out how to scale it. The number one thing we're looking for is what we refer to as founder market fit. So entrepreneurs that lived, breathed, experienced the problem that their business now solves, right? They bring tons of knowledge, obviously. They have great expertise, understand their customer and their end market better than anyone, but they also bring a ton of customer empathy. And we think that founder market fit is a proxy for product market fit, right? Usually those founders are serving what we would refer to as like medium-sized addressable markets. So not so small that it's never gonna be strategically relevant, and not so big that huge venture capitalists are gonna be wanting to invest. So it's the porridge is just right, so to speak. What we've experienced in the market is that like venture capital is extraordinarily enticing for entrepreneurs. But it's a horrible fit for like 99% of folks out there. And because their market's not big enough, because capital's not the key determinant in their success, whatever the reason. And we provide what we think is a really unique solution for those practical founders serving those kind of markets. And that's really the lifeblood of Growth Street.
So talk to me more about, if I'm listening right now, I'm like, hey, I've got an idea and I want to start a company, but I probably need to raise 200 grand, 500 grand, whatever the number is, and like some kind of seed funding. Like, are you really supportive of that, but you're not as supportive of like the VC part of it? Like, how would you explain that?
Yeah, so I think 9 out of 10 companies that we end up investing in have raised some modest amount of capital, call it, you know, less than $3-4 million.
Okay.
A lot of them have raised, you know, 500,000 to maybe 1.5 million, 2 million, something like that.
Okay.
And that can be like local angels. It can be a local seed firm, but it's not, they're not on the venture treadmill, right? They're not, you know, going to the big seed firms, the Series A, you know, getting on the track to raise alphabet soup, if you will, Series A, B, C, D, E. You know, they're trying to raise just enough money to get them off the ground, so to speak.
So I've seen this before, and definitely feels like the ones that go through the alphabet soup, as you described, like you get your Series A, it's like, here's $5 million, $10 million, spend it as fast as possible, but you've got to achieve these goals before you burn all the money, or you're going to run into a wall, right? And it's like, yeah. Then they've got to decide, well, you made enough progress, we're going to give you more money in a Series B, or you failed and we're shutting the thing down, right? But it feels like they're sort of pushing you to get to either one of those directions. Like, either you achieve the goals and we give you more money, or we're shutting the thing down. But like, they're trying to get you there as fast as possible is what it kind of feels like to me.
Yeah, totally. So that's kind of what I meant before when I said, like, you know, when you get on this this venture treadmill, you're pushing your chips to the center of the table all the time, right? You push all of your chips to the center of the table, you know, when you spend all of your Series A money, then you push it again to the table when you spend all of your Series B. And if you're a venture capitalist and you have 30, 40, 50 companies in a fund, like, that's the right advice to give your portfolio companies, like, go spend it, get as big as you can, see if it works, because they just want one or two or three of their companies to be awesome, right?
Right.
But for that founder, they're not diversified. Like,
no.
They, you know, they, all of their net worth is tied up in their business. So, you know, why would you push all of your chips to the table? Like, the reason why you would is because, you know, you're, you know, OpenAI, you're Tesla, you're whatever, and you have this ginormous TAM, and you're trying to change the world. If you're, you know, Mike Martin, who started Hotel Effectiveness, a labor management business outside of Atlanta, like, it would be crazy to push your chips to the table all, you know, all the time, and to swing for the fences, you know, raise once, get to a nice level of scale and sell the business for a really nice amount of money, and you don't get diluted and you don't take, you know, kind of undue risk along the way.
So not all VC money is this way, right? Like, not every firm is going to give you 5, 10, 15 million and be like, hey, you got to go spend it as fast as possible. You got to grow as fast as possible, right? Like, they're not all that way. Like, so how, I guess as a fund, how do you, you know, working with the company you're giving the money to, how do you kind of determine, like, how fast they should grow, how fast they should spend the money versus like, yeah, no, put most of it in the bank and like slowly try and figure this thing out before you go spend it all. Like, I mean, I know your guys' model is a little different than some of them, but like, how do you advise your portfolio companies that way though?
Well, so a couple things. One is, I haven't met a VC firm that doesn't say spend the money. You know, like, you raise enough money to get to the B, you raise enough money in the B to get to the C. You know, like, I don't, if you know of venture firms that don't have that model, you know, I'd be interested to hear about
it. I do. Have you heard of Grove Street Partners?
Yeah, there you go. We think of ourselves as a growth equity firm, you know, which is different. The thing that we tell our entrepreneurs all the time is that you never want to need money.
Right.
If you need money, you're in trouble, right? You know, honestly, even if they need money from us, you know, they're in trouble, right? So, you know, let's say we put $3-5 million on the balance sheet. You know, we're going to tell them, like, hey, you have the least amount of knowledge about how to spend that money when we first invest.
Yeah.
Right? So those dollars that you're spending there are the highest risk dollars. So let's not spend, you know, 4 million of the 5 million in year one. You know, let's spend 1 million of it and run some experiments and figure out where we're going to spend more skillfully, kind of in years 2, 3, 4. And hopefully, as you gain scale, it gets harder and harder to spend that money, right? Because you're generating more revenue, which is giving you more money to spend. That's how we think about it.
So when you invest, do you also allow the founders to take some secondary capital? So they take some money off the table, they personally take some of that money. So you give them 5 million, maybe a million goes to the founders or whatever. Like, do you guys do that as well? Do you recommend that?
Yes. So, we've made, I think, 14 investments, since we started. So we only make two or three investments per year. That's another interesting, difference between us and VC. The liquidity, I think on average, it's maybe like 40% of the dollars that we invest. So it's a meaningful amount of the dollars is going to liquidity to the founders and early investors. We love it. You know, so these entrepreneurs, when they first start a business, they're taking an obscene amount of risk.
Yeah.
Right. And then the business gets some traction. You got a million, 2 million of ARR. You're doing all this stuff. And you're like pulling back the reins because, you know, all the checks you're writing are with blood, you know?
Yeah.
You're like, oh my gosh, I've got to spend $200,000 to hire this person. You know, the business deserves you to hire that person, but, you know, you don't because your cash balance at your company's low, your cash balance in your personal checking account is low. And we like the idea of providing a little bit of liquidity to allow the entrepreneur to take the proper amount of risk for how much success the business has had.
It definitely lets them take the stress away, right? Like, yep. So even at full scale over the last 6 years, you know, we've seen ups and downs and all this through the economy. And you get to a point where you're like, man, we're making a lot of money every month. There's a lot of revenue coming in, but that doesn't mean I'm making a lot of money, right? So it's like, you know, and I saw this at my first company, Vint Solutions. We bootstrapped it to do 35 million a year in revenue. I wasn't making any money. Yeah. I mean, the company's making $3 million a month in revenue. I wasn't making any money. And we didn't have any working capital. We didn't have any money in the bank. Like, all the money comes in and goes right back out, right? So in these scenarios, sometimes it's great to be like, hey, if I could just put like $1 million in the bank, like life for Matt would be way better. Like the stress level would come way down. I would make better decisions. I would think longer in my strategy because I'm not worried about, you know, trying to keep this thing running every month. Like I can just dial it down a little bit.
Yeah, totally. The analogy we talk about is that when we invest, founders are looking at their toes, right? They're like, am I going to make payroll? You know, can I pay this, you know, vendor, whatever? That adds a lot of risk to the business and a lot of, it's just like we want to get them to pick their heads up, look out at the horizon, and think more strategically and think under lower duress, right? So that they can make better decisions. The easiest way to do that is just put a little money in their personal bank account, put a little money on the balance sheet of the company. And, you know, it can be miraculous, honestly.
I'm sure it can make a huge difference. And actually, when I sold my first company, that was our plan. You know, we were over 30 million in revenue. So we were a lot farther along, but we were trying to raise 30, 40 million and take half of that and put it, you know, in our own pockets and then swing for the fences, right? With the rest of it. But, we ended up getting such a good offer to sell. We're like, screw it. We're going to take the money and run as fast as we possibly can. Yeah. But honestly, there's still part of me today that looking back, I wish I would have never sold it. Wish I would have never sold that company, but that's a whole nother topic.
Yeah. By the way, that's, we actually love that. I wish, you know, we got to know you, or I got to know you many years ago and would have loved to have been an investor in your business. But like, we think there's like real product market fit for what Growth Street does because of exactly what you just said, right? Growth equity firms have raised so much money over the last 10 years that they've gone from being growth equity firms to growth buyout firms. Right.
Yeah. Private equity and stuff.
Yeah. They buy 60, 70, 80, 100% of your company. We buy, you know, 25 to 50% of your business. Right. And you get to have the second, third, fourth bite at the apple.
Yeah.
Right. And honestly, the people that are, you know, if you've got two to five, you weren't at 2 to 5 million, but like if the people that are at 2 to 5 million in ARR that want to sell 100% of their business, we're like, you know something we don't know about your business or your end market. You shouldn't want to sell that much.
Yeah.
You know, at 35 million, you know, they should, you know, I think you made a really smart decision, even if you wrestled with it sometimes. Like, you know, who are you protecting? Your great-great-grandchildren? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, and it was bootstrapped, so we didn't even give any of the money to any investors, so.
Yeah. Yeah. That, I mean, that's our number one competitor. Is like the Matt Watson of the world, were the Matt Watsons of the world that just like believe really deeply in their company, and they're willing to make all of the financial sacrifices to get to 30 or 35 million, you know? Yeah. You know, people have families, you know, they have other needs, and, you know, being able to offer a deal where we invest and we own 30% of their company and we put some money in their bank account, and they still own a huge chunk of the company. It's pretty darn attractive. We get great founders that really believe in their businesses, which is awesome.
You know, so earlier you mentioned that VC is bad for probably 99% of companies. And we talked about one of the reasons is, you know, you invest a lot of money in them and they expect them to take off like a rocket, and the VC doesn't really care if they explode because they made like 10 investments and they just need like two of them to work, right? But I was curious if you had any other reasons of like why you think it's bad for like 99% of people.
I think most of the time, like the TAMs just aren't, the total addressable markets just aren't big enough for those companies. You know, and capital is not the key determinant of their success. So like we sometimes have found these businesses that like are serving like a niche on a niche, you know, they're a feature, not a platform, you know, for
right.
Kind of like old VC speak. And they raise gobs and gobs of money, and the opportunity isn't big enough for them to sell for $1 billion, you know? And then the other one is like, we think that there are certain opportunities where like that domain expertise that that our founders from industry really bring give them an unfair advantage, you know, a right mm-hmm. to win in their market. And, you know, we've competed against people that raise, you know, tens of millions of dollars, but the capital isn't going to be, you know, it would take them 6 months to build what we have. But they decide not to build it because they don't know that that's important, you know, if that makes sense.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I want to give another answer to this question, a couple other answers. And one of these comes actually from Greg Head, who we talked about before, who's great, Practical Founders. Check out Practical Founders group and podcast, all the things. Greg's great. But one of the things that Greg always talks about in this conversation is when you take the VC money, it then kind of takes away your choice. Like potentially like, hey, I could bootstrap this thing. It could be a lifestyle company. I could try and get a single, a double, a triple. Like, yeah, I'm not going to sell it for $100 million, but I can grow at my own pace. I can do whatever I want to do. It feels like as soon as you take the VC money though, like that, a lot of that decision-making kind of goes out. Like you have less decision-making capability now that you've got this VC on your back. Like to me, I feel like that's one of the reasons to be careful about the choice and the right partner that you pick, right? If you're yeah. if you're gonna go the VC route, the growth equity part out route, picking the right partner that gives you still the decision making ability to kind of go whatever way you want to go.
Yeah, I mean it's interesting that you say that because we think about that a lot too, right? Like especially as a minority investor, we don't get to control the company, right? So we better have a shared vision with the entrepreneur,
right?
You know, and so you know when we before we invest, we prepare what we refer to as like an exit one pager, which is, you know, like what is the business going to look like when we sell? Because we can't be investors forever, right?
Right.
And maybe we should change the term of exit because the exit, you know, an exit can look like a lot of different things, but we want to make sure with that one pager that the entrepreneur and Growth Street are fully aligned, right? that this is what we want the business to look like. This is, you know, this is the software that they're going to use. This is what the team's going to look like. This is what the product might look like. And we'll get a lot of things wrong. But if you did that, you know, with your venture firm and you all got aligned, then great, you know. But I think a lot of the times the people go in, you know, pretty ignorant, you know, and they don't realize, you know, like, oh, this person gave me, you know, $10 million at this enormous valuation. You know, it's not successful for them unless we get to here, you know. And if it's not successful for them until we get to there, then they're going to force me to make these crazy decisions.
Right. You know? Well, and if you turn it around to the flip side of the founder, like one of my friends here in Kansas City went through this. Like he had a lot of success, took some money from a big VC fund, was mildly successful, and ultimately ran into some cash issues at the end, needed to raise a bunch of money or just sell, and they ultimately, the board and everybody decided to just sell. He didn't actually get any money at all in this thing. Like it sold for like, I think, tens of millions of dollars, and he got nothing. And the reason he got nothing is because of all the liquidation preferences, yeah, all the preferred returns to the VC. The VCs and the other investors got all the money, and the founder ended up with nothing, right? And, you know, all those terms, the liquidation preferences, the preferred returns, all those things can come back to bite you as well when you go down this path. Like you're talking about, I did Series A, I did Series B, I raised this tens of millions of dollars. Well, that means you're going to have to sell for a lot more than that just to pay back the investors, right? Like, yeah, you're taking on so much more risk to ever get anything out of this thing because of all of their preferred returns. And that's the hidden risk here that most people just don't think about. Like they're aiming for the moon. Like we're going to be a unicorn, but if you don't get there, you probably get nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a really sad reality, you know, and we like to think at Growth Street that when we make an investment, we're making it one and done, right? So we are convertible preferred. So there is a liquidation preference, but we're not stacking liquidation preference on liquidation.
You want your money back.
Yeah.
You should.
Yes. We tell them all the time, we're like, hey, we're not going to swing for the fences. But, you know, if we get this right, we can have venture style returns too. You know, like... We've had some that are, you know, well north of 10x outcomes.
Wow.
The entrepreneurs made out like bandits because they only did one raise, you know?
Right.
And so we're not taking that off the table, so to speak, right? You can opportunistically raise again, even if you want to. We've done that too. You know, we've had wonderful partners where, you know, we got into a business when it was relatively small, grew really fast. We brought in Spectrum Equity as a partner, and they've been great. You know, and so we're not taking these options off the table, but we're going to run the business with you, and we're going to partner with a founder that wants to run the business in a practical way, right? Like Greg Head, we were talking about him before. He likes to call Growth Street Serious A Capital rather than Series A Capital.
Yeah.
And we love that. You know, that's, we think of ourselves as Series A Capital too.
Well, I do want to take a minute to remind everybody today's episode is brought to you by Fullscale. We help build software development teams for other tech companies, front-end developers, back-end developers, whatever your tech stack is. We help build a team out of the Philippines. It's one of the actually best places in the world to do software development for about half the cost of hiring somebody in the U.S. So you can check us out at fullscale.io. You know, Steve, I want to go back to a different conversation we started earlier about founder market fit. And actually, it's really timely because I wrote a blog post about this I was getting ready to publish, but now I think I'm going to wait and include some more of this content into my blog post that I'll publish in another week or so. And the title of the blog was, Why Are You the Right Person to Start This Company? Like, what is it about you that gives you an advantage? And I think about this a lot when I meet with other founders now that have whatever business idea. I'm like, why are you the person to create this company? Like, if 100 people all had this exact same idea today, why would you win and the other 99 would lose, right? There has to be some tangible that you bring to it, right? Industry experience, you know, you understand the problem better than anybody else, whatever. Like, there's got to be a reason why you. I guess there doesn't have to be a reason. Like, some of us dumb luck into this and we get lucky. But more often than not, like, I think you would agree to me, like, there's a reason why.
Yeah, absolutely. Founder market fit is like the foundation of our investment philosophy and our investment thesis every time we make a new investment. We basically ask ourselves, like, do you have the experience, the network, and the passion, you know, to have a right to win in this category, right? It's not going to be a straight line, you know? And so being able to lean on those things when you're building your company is incredibly important. You know, like, you're going to lose a big customer. You're going to lose a key employee. You're going to be tight on payroll. And, you know, you need to have it in your being that you're going to win, you know, and that you're really passionate about helping this industry or really passionate about solving this problem. And then you also need to be able to lean on those relationships that you have, you know, all those things.
Yeah.
I mean, when we've been, you know, burned in quotes, when we've invested, is that the person doesn't really have a right to win in that category. You know, we think they do, we convince ourselves, but they didn't really live the problem that their business is now solving.
Well, so I have a list here. Let me run through this list. Okay. So industry experience and problem expertise, right? Those are probably the most common things you think of. Industry connections in general can be huge, right? You're like, hey, you have some idea. Maybe you're not even an expert on the idea, yeah, but you have all the connections. You know all the people, right? You know how to sell this thing, right? And that in itself is magical.
Yeah, and by the way, right? On that one, like, you can like test ideas with them. Like, you call them up and you're like, this is how I'm thinking about this. Or like, would you demo the product or do whatever? And you get like the world's foremost expert to give you early advice. I mean, it's critical.
Yeah. And this is the number one and number two here is probably why I should have stayed in automotive. Like, my first company was in automotive. If I would have stayed in automotive, it would have gave me like a radical advantage, right? Where I decided to leave automotive. Like, I should have stayed there, but I walked away from that advantage.
You're a young man, Matt. You're a young man. You can do it.
Yeah. All right. So the third one I had on my list was just like a following and an influence. Like, if you have a following on LinkedIn or TikTok or whatever it is, like, odds are you can probably do a lot of things. And because you just naturally have that following, you'll be successful for whatever reason.
Yeah. We're talking to a company now where the founder has 18,000 followers on LinkedIn. And we're wondering about something in their product. He was like, oh, I'll just run a survey.
Yeah.
He runs a survey, and in 4 days, we get like 350 responses. And like,
yeah,
I mean, it's hard to overestimate the value of that.
So I have 45,000 followers on LinkedIn now, and it drives almost all of our business at Full Scale. Like, 75% of all of our leads at Full Scale come from my LinkedIn activity. And odds are, if I wanted to do something else, it would be really powerful. So I had somebody tell me one day they need to hire a CTO. So I'm like, all right, no problem. Let me post on LinkedIn for you. Dude, I got like 100 messages in the next day. And I spent so much time going through these messages and then sending them to the guy. I'm like, hey, here's another one, here's another one, here's another one. I should have been a freaking recruiter and got paid for that one. But it just goes to show the power, right? Yeah. If you build that following, that influence, it can be really powerful for whatever it is you want to do. It takes a long time to build that following, but it's super valuable. That's another reason.
Yep.
Let me go to the next one on my list here is simply funding and resources. Now, granted, to your point earlier, like, money does not solve all problems, but dang, it doesn't hurt. Like, sometimes just having the money to do the things you need to do will ultimately help you win, even if you suck at everything else. Sometimes the money alone can make a difference.
Yeah, I agree. A personal friend of mine, her father has a line. He says, money doesn't make you happy, but neither does poverty. Go make some money, you know, which is pretty crazy. But I agree with you that, like, you do need capital to be successful. You know, how much do you need, and raising the proper amount is, you know, is really critical to your success too. Like, it's hard enough to build a business, you know, just, you know, like, you know, having the right team, having the right product, having, picking the right market, all these things. But if your cap table isn't aligned with what's the right outcome for your company, it just makes it that much harder. So if you don't have enough capital, that's a problem. If you have too much capital, that's also a problem. I think people forget that having too much capital is also a problem.
Yeah. People do dumb stuff with it.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So the next one on my list, I got three more here. The next one on my list is a world-class team. I mean, sometimes you just have like two or three people that are just amazing. They work great together. They could probably literally do anything. I'm going to guess you've seen some of these people too. Like, you ran into these founding teams. You're like, these people are just amazing. Like, whatever they do, I know they're going to conquer it. So
yeah.
I want to support them.
We have one internal test. It's very subjective. But when we evaluate a new company, we're talking to the entrepreneur and we meet some of the members of their team. If they have one person on that team that we think is better than the founder, and better is like in quotes, you know,
right,
smarter, whatever, more experienced, and I don't know, it tells us so much about that entrepreneur and about the company's opportunity. Like, if
yes.
you can hire somebody that's that good, then the opportunity must be good. That the founder must be humble enough, you know,
right.
To be able to have that person. There's just, the team is so important in the early days of a business.
All right. So next on my list is just simply having a first mover advantage. Sometimes that's what it is too, right? It's like, the reason you're going to be successful is you were the first person to come up with this idea and you've got a head start, but you've got to keep going. Like, you've got to make the most out of it.
Yeah. We don't do a ton of thinking about at Growth Street. Maybe we should. Oftentimes that can be like a false positive for us, where, you know, if you're the only one doing it, because these businesses, I said, you know, they're 2 to 5 million of ARR. If you're the only one doing it, or you're the first one to do it, maybe that means that the opportunity is really small.
Yeah.
The opportunity is not that good, you know, because nowadays it's so easy to start a software company. Like, you know, you're leasing everything. You're leasing the software, you're leasing AWS, you're leasing people, you're leasing all this stuff. So there isn't really a big capital investment. So if there aren't a bunch of people doing it, that might be a bad sign.
100%. And I've so after the last like 10 or 15 years of watching the like startup community in Kansas City,
yeah.
seems like there's some ideas, like somebody tries to do the exact same thing like every 3 years, and I'm like, I've seen this thing fail like
yeah.
for every reason. Like, this is clearly not a like problem that somebody is going to solve and monetize. And
yeah.
you ever see that? You like see the same like crap over and over again.
Definitely.
You're like, nobody's ever going to solve this, or there's no money in it.
Yeah. I think, you know, over the course of my career, I've seen that happen. And I think earlier in my career, I would be like, oh, you know, maybe they've got a different way to do this, or like, you know, maybe I didn't think about it the right way the first time. And now I'm like, keep it simple, stupid. You know, like, if you've seen that before and you've seen it fail, like, it, you know, it just move on, you know?
Yeah, somebody would have figured this out by now.
Exactly, yeah.
All right, so the last one on my list is having an existing customer base. And so in this case, it could be like, hey, you're building a new product and you're able to, you know, the reason that you should build that new product or new like secondary business is because your, you know, existing customer base you can sell into. And do you ever end up in deals like that where like, hey, we're kind of built this other thing over here and
yeah.
and it's like a spinoff or whatever?
Not really a spinoff, but so we think of ourselves almost as like real estate investors, you know, so like we want to invest in a really nice plot of land, you know. We don't need to build a New York City high rise, but we want to build a nice piece of property. We want it to have a nice access to transportation, you know, highways, airports, all that stuff. And if you have that really nice plot of land, you can sell all sorts of other stuff to your customers. So like the plot of land would be, you know, you've got 100 customers that love you in this attractive market, go sell them other stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the most efficient way to grow your business. It's the most, it's like the most attractive risk reward, right? And so 100%. A lot of growth streets help actually after we invest is like helping them think that through. So HR Acuity is a employee relations management software business. They've got, you know, hundreds and hundreds of customers, really attractive customers. We help them think through like, well, you have your core module. What about selling this additional capability into the base? And it really opens up the TAM. So now all of a sudden your market gets bigger. You're much more likely to convert those customers to buying more modules than you are to convert a new prospect, right? And the business has grown incredibly quickly and very efficiently. And a lot of it's because they're just, you know, selling back into the base, which is awesome.
Well, I definitely agree with you that founder market fit's a thing, and people usually need to have some kind of intangible that helps them, like, why are they different than anybody else? And I'm really glad you agree with that. I think it was ironic. It aligns with my blog post next week. So speaking of that, if you're not subscribed to my newsletter, you can go to startuphustle.xyz and subscribe to our newsletter or follow me on LinkedIn and stuff. So I wanted to go back to something else we were talking about earlier. So a lot of the companies that you're working with have largely bootstrapped or lightly funded, and then they kind of get to a point where they need your help at Grocery Partners. And I imagine a lot of them need help with just how to scale. They're like, we need the money and we need to scale. I'm curious, for a lot of the companies you work with, like, what are their challenges at that scale? Is it usually sales and marketing? It's usually not probably product, right? Or what is it that you usually have to help them with?
I mean, interestingly enough, it's all of the above, you know, like, so if you're a founder from industry, you have incredible domain expertise, obviously, you know, you really understand the problem you're solving. So there's, I would say, like, lower on the list is product, maybe, because they are the product leader of the company. But outside of that, you know, they have spent so much time in the industry, but they have spent very little time building a B2B SaaS business, right?
Yeah.
And so they just don't know, or maybe they do know, but they don't have a ton of confidence around, hey, should I hire this person first or this person first? Should, you know, like, and we just give them lots of tips and tricks, you know, so that they stub their toe less frequently. You know, it's like, always hire salespeople in twos, you know, don't hire one salesperson. You know, they hire two, have them compete with each other. One's not going to do very well. They're going to churn out, you know. There are just all sorts of things like that over time that we've learned. We'd like to think that that's how our skills and experience are really complementary to that founder from industry.
Very good. Well, I really appreciate having you on the show today. I'm a huge fan of what you guys do. I'm honestly not a huge fan of the crazy VC treadmill we talked about earlier. I would want to try to avoid that unless I just had the right thing that was like taken off like a rocket, you know, like that's OpenAI or whatever it is. Like, I get it. But for the average vertical SaaS company that's just kind of growing and bumping along, like, I think it makes way more sense to bootstrap and then come to somebody like you when it's time to like, hey, I need $5 million to take this to the next level. And that's the only money they probably need, right? Like, I'm a huge fan.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it. I'm a huge fan of yours. I really wanted to invest behind you many years ago, and I'll take a podcast invite as a consolation prize.
Yeah. I'll still take the money.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I'm sure you're going to keep starting things, and we love serial entrepreneurs, and hopefully we'll get the opportunity to work together.
Well, awesome. So tell them a little more about how to get a hold of you guys, how to follow you guys. You guys, you know, are there different channels that they can follow you on? Or
yeah, so GrowthStreetPartners.com. We also are on LinkedIn, obviously. We've done some, posts on LinkedIn that I think for practical founders, they might really appreciate. We've done a few different podcasts, and you can find all that, both on our website and on our LinkedIn. But honestly, just email me directly, steve@growthstreetpartners.com. And, we're small enough, we're engaged enough, that we'll make sure that we are timely in our response.
Well, awesome. Once again, this was Steve Wolf, Grove Street Partners. Thank you so much for doing this today.
Thanks, man.
Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time.